Did Shakespeare write the 37 some odd plays that go under his name? The debate surrounding what is called the Shakespeare authorship question is not new. It actually goes back as far as 1845, when doubts were first raised concerning whether it was the man born in Stratford-on-Avon or someone else who wrote not only the plays but the sonnets and the dramatic poems like Venus and Adonis. Well, now there is a new candidate on the horizon. His name is John Florio, or Giovanni Florio, born in 1553 in London, but of Italian parentage. If it were ever to be proved that John Florio wrote the Shakespearean canon, the impact that this would have on the interpretation of that very canon would be absolutely enormous. Before focusing on John Florio, let's refresh our memories concerning the long history of the Shakespeare authorship question. In the first place, why is there a debate at all? The main reason is that the man, William Shakespeare, seems to have had very little education. He chalked up little more than 4 or 5 years of schooling, which meant that he did learn the 3 R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, but little else. What's more, this man who wrote plays that are jam-packed with erudition does not seem to have owned a single book. He did not even have a copy of the Bible. And what about his will, his testament? It is quite long and terribly dull, stylistically speaking. And what's more, Shakespeare did not even consider it important to mention in his will that he was a playwright. And when he dies, no one seems to notice. Shakespeare is not referred to as a writer by his contemporaries either during his lifetime or at the moment of his death. So this is the basic starting point for what are called the anti-Stratfordians, which is the name given to those who, over the last 160 years, have thought that this country bumpkin born in Stratford simply could not have authored the plays that are among the greatest pieces of literature the world over. Shakespeare has been the object of what in English-speaking countries is called bardolatry. Bardolatry is a word that is meant to signify the adulation one is wont to show toward the bard. It was launched by David Garrick, the great 18th century Shakespearean actor. But in 1845, the first cracks start to show up in the house of bardolatry. On that year, an American woman by the name of Delia Bacon put forth the hypothesis that the Shakespearean canon had not been written by the man from Stratford, but by a coterie of authors, essentially Sir Walter Raleigh and Edmund Spenser, working under the aegis or the guiding hand of Sir Francis Bacon. Delia Bacon, we have to remember, lived at a time when authorship as such was being severally questioned. Both biblical and Homeric studies had been showing since the latter part of the 18th century that, no, sorry, Moses did not write single-handedly the book of Genesis, and similarly that Homer did not write single-handedly the Odyssey. But that both of these works were written by a community of poets or writers working through time. So, Delia Bacon was, as it were, a woman of her times. She was working within the new parameters that were then being established by biblical and Homeric scholarship. Delia Bacon was quite an amazing woman. She was born in 1811 in a log cabin in Ohio. She became a teacher and later a public speaker of great talent. She would travel from city to city speaking without notes. She was eloquent, highly convincing. Her theories concerning Francis Bacon and his team of authors attracted the attention and support of greats like Nathaniel Hawthorne, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Walt Whitman, and others. But it was only in 1857 that Delia Bacon finally published her book outlining her theory, a book that was, alas, not very well written and that bore the rather portentous title The Philosophy of the Plays of Shakespeare Unfolded. Alas, shortly after this publication, she became mentally ill and spent the last 2 years of her life destitute and moving from one mental institution to another, a fact that did not help her cause. However that may be, Delia Bacon had ignited something. Since the middle of the 19th century, the authorship debate has become a booming industry. Over the last 100 years or so, no less than 70 candidates have been proposed. And as you might expect, the majority of these is not worth a moment's thought. Of the 70-some-odd candidates, only 3 may be considered worth a second look. I have already mentioned Sir Francis Bacon. The 2 other candidates that are deemed worthy of attention are Christopher Marlowe and Edward de Vere. The first to propose Christopher Marlowe as a candidate is a man called Wilbur Ziegler, who published a novel in 1895 called It Was Marlowe, A Story of the Secret of the 3 Centuries. This piece of fiction then inspired a number of non-fiction writers to take up this particular cause. But the Marlowians, as they are called, have to deal with one bummer of an obstacle. Marlowe was assassinated in 1593. That is, at a time when plays such as Macbeth, Hamlet, or King Lear had not yet been written. Not to be put down, the Marlowians respond with a yarn about Marlowe's having faked his own murder. He is then supposed to have fled to Italy, where he would have written the rest of the plays that had yet to be written. From his sunny Italian exile, Marlowe would simply have sent the plays back one by one to England to an actor called William Shakespeare, who was, of course, part of this whole cover-up. And this Shakespeare fellow would have pawned off the plays as his own. One can only reply to the Marlowians, "Nice try, guys." While this may be the stuff of thrillers, it remains that it's a bit hard to swallow. Finally, the third candidate worthy of comment is Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford. His supporters are called Oxfordians. His candidacy was promoted by a certain John Thomas Loney in a book published in 1920 entitled Shakespeare Identified. This is a book that was read by Sigmund Freud, who was himself a convinced Oxfordian. Freud would even give Loney's book as a gift to his friends, colleagues, and even to his patients. Orson Welles and Sir Laurence Olivier were both enthusiastic Oxfordians. Now, who was this Edward de Vere? He was an aristocrat who wrote a number of comedies that were highly esteemed in his own day, but none of these plays have survived. In 1987, three bona fide chief justices of the Supreme Court of the United States held a moot court, which is a legal term for court proceedings that are held purely for educational purposes. And so Oxfordian lawyers had it out with Stratfordian lawyers. The event got a lot of media coverage and over 1,000 people attended. At the end of it all, the three chief justices rendered their decision, a decision that went narrowly in favor of the man from Stratford. But a number of years later, the three chief justices all declared that if the moot court were ever to be held again, their decision would this time lean in favor of Edward de Vere. So there you have the three candidates in the running: Francis Bacon, Christopher Marlowe, and Edward de Vere. Now, of course, it is quite legitimate to ask, who cares who wrote Shakespeare's plays? Didn't Hamlet say, the play's the thing, and not the guy who wrote the play? And of course, ever since Roland Barthes and Michel Foucault came out with this notion about the death of the author, an obvious sequel to Nietzsche's Death of God, we can no longer muster up that much interest for an authorship debate of any kind. For us modernists or postmodernists or whatever it is we want to call ourselves, this metaphysical entity called the author has lost all of its prestige. To us, an author is little more than a traffic cop trying to keep cars from running into each other at a busy intersection in an impossibly busy modern city. And just as a traffic cop directs the flow of cars, he does not build, that is, he does not create the cars, so the author does not really create the texts that swarm about him, but simply tries to have them go safely on their way. Now, if this is true, that a writer is just a traffic cop, then the Shakespearean authorship question is little more than a parlor game, in the sense that knowing who wrote the Shakespeare canon has little or no impact on how we interpret that canon. Unless the candidate were not to be English. And this is where this new candidate becomes interesting. I am talking about John Florio, or Giovanni Florio, that I mentioned at the outset. All of the 70-some-odd candidates that have been proposed over the last 160 years have been English-born and bred, all of them. The only exception is John Florio, who, though born in London in 1553, had the DNA of a foreigner. If we accept John Florio as a serious candidate, then we are assisting in planting a bomb in the field of Shakespearean studies. John Florio's candidacy has just recently been put forward by Lamberto Tassinari, a teacher of Italian language and literature at the Université de Montréal. Tassinari's book, published in 2009, is titled John Florio, the Man Who Was Shakespeare. Now, if anyone had the wherewithal to write all of those plays and sonnets, it was this man called John Florio. The wherewithal in terms of scholarship, style, linguistic abilities, background, life history, and so forth. Well, who was he? John Florio was a lexicographer who wrote principally dictionaries. He was a polyglot who had mastered some seven languages: Italian, Hebrew, Greek, French, Latin, Spanish, German, English, of course. Lamberto Tassinari begins his book with a quote from Jorge Luis Borges, and I quote, "Shakespeare is the least English of English writers. It would come to us as no surprise," Borges goes on to say, "to learn that Shakespeare had been Italian or Jewish," end of quote. In other words, for Borges, Shakespeare's foreignness is a given. When Borges says that Shakespeare's plays are un-English, one can only agree. The plays are filled with much sound and fury. They are cut of a rugged cloth. They partake of an aesthetics of the excessive. And in that way, well, they just don't seem very English. In short, Shakespeare's theatre is more in a style that one would label as proto-Baroque. There is a grand mannerist energy in his plays that put them more in a league with a painter like Tintoretto than with anything being written at the time in England. And of course, one will take note here of the fact that some 16 of the 37 plays written by Shakespeare are set in Italy. Romeo and Juliet is set in Verona. The Merchant of Venice and Othello take place in Venice. The Two Gentlemen of Verona is set in Verona, of course, but also in Milan, and so forth. Oh, and did I mention that John Florio's father, Michelangelo Florio, was of Jewish descent? That he had been a Catholic friar before becoming a Calvinist preacher with an intimate knowledge of the Bible, a knowledge which the father passed on to the son? The man who wrote the Shakespearean canon would have been immensely erudite. He would have known the various sciences, mathematics, astronomy, medicine, law, art, music. He would have been familiar with military and naval terminology. He would also have had an intimate knowledge of the courtly life and manners of France, England, and Italy. Now, it turns out that John Florio absolutely fits the bill here. He was one of the most learned men in the England of his day. And it would not be an exaggeration to say that John Florio was one of the key players who helped bring about the brief English Renaissance of the 16th and early 17th centuries. Lamberto Tassinari goes to great pains to show how Florio's style is the mirror image of Shakespeare's style. He shows how Florio greatly enhanced, and one might even say reinvented, the English language. Florio's avowed goal was to make of the English language one of the most powerful poetic languages ever to hit the world stage. For instance, Florio is, still today, much admired for his highly creative translation of Montaigne's essays. This translation had Florio invent a bevy of English words and expressions to better render Montaigne's text into English. In this manner, Florio greatly extended the power of the English language. And so Tassinari goes on to show how Florio and Shakespeare had the same linguistic mannerisms, same approach, same stylistic urgency, same themes, the theme of exile, for instance. In short, Florio's fingerprints are all over the Shakespearean canon. As I mentioned before, all 70 or so previous candidates have been English, but here with John Florio we are dealing with a foreigner, a stranger, an alien, if you will, for John Florio's DNA is that of a continental European. A Shakespeare made in Europe would set the whole Shakespeare interpretation industry upside down. It would set it ablaze. And this, I admit, is what I find extremely exciting. England has always remained rather standoffish when it came to continental Europe, but here, with John Florio, we would be dealing with a situation where England's greatest writer would actually have been a bloody foreigner. So there you have it. Is John Florio the man who was Shakespeare? To quote one last time the title of Lamberto Tassinari's book. Well, one thing is sure. In the case of John Florio, we can no longer quote Hamlet, because here the play is not the thing, not the only thing. In the case of John Florio, the man who wrote the plays becomes a key concern if you want to come to grips with and understand fully the Shakespearean canon. I'm Robert Richard for CKCU Literary News in Montreal, Quebec.